Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, your host, and today we'll be interviewing Dr. John Mills about his most recent publication, Conundrums, A Critique of Contemporary Psychoanalysis, published by Routledge. Dr. Mills is a philosopher, a psychologist, and a psychoanalyst. He's on the editorial board of Psychoanalytic Psychology, the editor of two book series, as well as the author of 11 books, including Origins on the Genesis of Psychic Reality, which was published by McGill Queen's University Press 2010. Dr. Mills, like New Books in Psychoanalysis, is a winner of the Gradiva Award from the National Association for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis. He won for his book Origins in 2011. And New Books in Psychoanalysis, we're proud to say, has just won in the category of New Media in 2012. Dr. Mills maintains a private practice as well as runs a mental health corporation in Ontario, Canada. Today we'll be speaking with him about his critique of the relational turn and its philosophical underpinnings. And he raises questions about the use of postmodernism, whither goest the body, the unconscious, and drives in the turn toward the here and now, and toward relating and ways of relating as being made primary in the consulting room. I think that people who are interested in these issues of self-disclosure, critiques of the analyst's authority, who knows? Does the analyst know anything anyway? Should the analyst be in a position of the one who is supposed to know? And other critiques that the relational movement has have leveled on the more classical analytic approach. All of those kinds of topics are going to be taken up here. And hope that you'll enjoy. We encourage you to go and like us on Facebook. Why not? And we also encourage you to write in if you have commentary and to let people know about this interview and about this program. So let's move forward to the interview without further ado. Hi, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, your host as always, and today we'll be speaking with Dr. John Mills about his book Conundrums, which has a subtitle, A Critique of Contemporary Psychoanalysis, published by Routledge. Welcome, Dr. Mills, to New Books in Psychoanalysis.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. We're excited to have you here today. In fact, when I read your book, I thought, I'm not trained in philosophy, but I was extremely interested in many of the ideas. The book has a critique of the relational psychoanalytic movement, and that I found very compelling. These were ideas, I guess, sort of unthought knowns that had been floating around in my mind for quite some time. And reading your book was almost like putting thoughts that I had and hadn't articulated fully into words. So it's a treat to have you here. Would you tell us a bit just set it up for the listeners. Tell us about your book.
Well, broadly, I believe it is a contribution to the history of ideas in terms of where psychoanalysis has come from and where it is today. I'm primarily interested in this project by explicating various types of paradigms within contemporary thought, and that mainly is within the relational camp, as well as intersubjective and postmodern theories. So I am trying to provide a systematic critique of the contemporary field, but I'm certainly not inclusive. I do not entertain contemporary empirical research or neuroscience or other dimensions that certainly are worthy of looking at. I just had to limit the scope of this project to mainly those three areas. And I'm broadly looking at theory as well as modes of practice, as well as politics, ethical parameters of our practice, and also approaching some type of consilience in the field. Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, that's what I'm trying to broadly get at.
Mm-hmm. What drew you to focus, as I think you do, I think you focus a bit more on relational work as opposed to intersubjective work. What was it about relational thinking that seemed to capture your attention and got you wanting to say to speak to that tradition?
Well, for one, I would want to say that I practice as a relational analyst, so I'm very much drawn to the freedom and humanness and flexibility that the relational movement has brought to the field in terms of opening up a certain permissible space for us to act in the consulting room in ways that perhaps the classically trained analyst or caricature of the analyst might appear like. So that was one reason why I was drawn to reading the literature, because I found in many ways a refreshing point of view, but also within the way of doing research and reading a variety of different people, I was also struck by a lack of philosophical sophistication, and particularly looking at how relationality is being pitted against in a binary fashion against Freudian metapsychology. Mm-hmm. And in my view, that's misguided and not necessary. So I think there was certainly a critique along the lines of theory as I'm reading, but at the same time feeling an identification with the liberties of practice.
Mm-hmm. Do you think I wonder, as I've read a lot of, and I've interviewed a number of relational thinkers, and I wonder what it is about why this is an American phenomenon. And I know you're Canadian, so you can look at this phenomenon as sort of a cultural, you have a different vantage point, let's put it this way. And it strikes me as a very American movement. I'm wondering, is it possible that the emphasis on relatedness has made psychoanalysis somehow, I've heard people say this, more palatable, it's less frightening, it's more civilized than, let's say, the emphasis on the drives and the unconscious? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, it's a broad topic. I would think, on one hand, you're absolutely correct. When we talk about what do you do, how do you relate to people? Like, what do you say in your sessions? That the last thing that people would probably expect is for someone to be silent, say nothing, withhold certain humanness, mm-hmm. and then spew out interpretations down the road. I don't think that any of us would probably keep very many people in our practice if that's how we acted.
Right.
But in terms of, jettisoning the notion of drives and the unconscious, I you know, I just cannot fathom that that would be a very, you know, useful, let alone a productive or, you know, or fruitful project, because that would be jettisoning the very foundations of our profession. And it's important that we historically understand where we come from, as well as the key tenets that undergird what we buy. And one thing is that, you know, classical theory is certainly not dead by any means. Mm-hmm. And we have to appreciate the nature of embodiment. Mm-hmm. So that when we speak about drive, that's really what we're getting at, how the complexities of our embodiment is enacted. And clearly, if we are to jettison the notion of that, we are also precariously having to, you know, displace an unconscious ontology. So I cannot envision psychoanalysis flourishing without remaining connected, at least in some fashion, to its unconscious and embodied theses.
Well, I guess... you know, I was thinking about it. I was reading Rosemary Balsam. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her work, and she has a new book called Women's Bodies in Psychoanalysis. And she has a quote that I think is pretty interesting when it comes to the contemporary response to drive theory. She says, "If drive theory and conflict defensive operations are dismissed as irrelevant, then penis envy, castration anxiety, and denigration of the clitoris do thankfully disappear as focal to a developmental theory about women. Yet the proponents of the alternative theories," and I think here she's referencing the relational, the intersubjective, "do not offer any developmental theory that pays as close attention to the body as Freud did."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's so, and in a way, I think what she's suggesting is that what we have are some feminist critiques of the more classical approach, you know, privileging penis envy or the Oedipal in a certain way. And so it's an attempt to move away from a biological essentialism. But can we have drives without biological essentialism?
I found what you read was quite, you know, in simpatico with my line of thinking.
Totally, yeah.
But the issue of jettisoning drives, I mean, we have to ask ourselves, what do we mean by a drive? And traditionally, I don't believe the field really understands what Freud was saying. Mm-hmm. They never read his works, particularly, you know, in the German. And there's an entirely different feel. You know, what we have are these English translations, such as instinct. But there's also a conditioning that we undergo when we do our training, that somehow these are antiquated categories.
Right.
And so the notion of embodiment or gendered embodiment is something that, of course, you know, cannot just be dismissed. It would be like dismissing, you know, an empirical fact,
mm-hmm.
you know, such as that we, you know, we have hunger, or, you know, that we have to sleep, or we have to eat, and or have sex. And I mean, these are things that are just given. It's the way we want to go about interpreting how they provide a basis for experience. And experience is, of course, organized on much higher, you know, realms and in different spheres of psychic reality. So I really think that there can be all these discourses that are valid and operative, but some are going to be more relevant, particularly, you know, to practice than others.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've replaced the term drive with desire.
Yeah.
And you know, and our desires, of course, lead to conflicts. They lead to, you know, affective dysregulations that are still part of our embodiment, not to separate them out, such as, you know, drives are separate from feelings or emotions, or they're separate from motivation, they're separate from cognition. These are all very much operative together, and yet you know, yet we, the way we go about talking about it, sometimes we don't understand people's discourses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was also thinking that in the book you have even a number of chapters that you sort of move sequentially, and you begin with, after your introduction, you begin with a critique of the use of postmodernism in psychoanalysis. And I guess I wanted to ask, first of all, why do you think psychoanalysis, aside from, you know, this being a contemporary moment and postmodernism as a theory, is you know, a sort of a school of thought, a theory of philosophy, that's very popular in the last, you know, 25, 30 years. But why do you think psychoanalysis has gotten itself so involved with postmodern thinking? What's the relationship there as you see it?
Well, you know, it can be appealing on many levels. I think particularly it, for those who are, have a certain element of personal experiences that just they cannot relate to other people, or they've identified with certain groups that have historically been disenfranchised, whether it be feminist or post-feminist or racial or ethnic groups, or those who just simply don't fit into the establishment, the GLIP populations. People were. Where difference is magnified and they're comparing themselves to the so-called, quote, norm, this would draw attention to them. But, you know, the one thing that the postmodern project brings is a number of conundrums. And so we have to be careful about the political and ethical motivations behind adopting a postmodern turn versus what theoretical contributions they uniquely bring.
Mm-hmm. I was had the thought as I was reading your chapter on postmodernism. I wonder, you know, you can sit with a patient and you can really feel stupid, like you have no idea what's happening. For a long time, you know, and you have to tolerate feeling stupid and in the dark and insignificant and unsure. And I began to think about the turn toward postmodernism as sort of giving people a way that maybe the classical theory didn't to reckon with or to make okay having some of those feelings. Does that make any sense to you?
Maybe it helped for me to understand, what do you mean by postmodernism?
Well, that's a good question. I'm thinking of sort of the critique, the idea that there's, there's no, quote, self. You can't fully know oneself, that there's a limit, that it's perspectival, that I can only see you within the limits of, my own context, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I think some of those ideas I see floating around and being used by analysts in their writing about postmodern thinking in the psychoanalytic frame.
Yes. I guess I'd have to challenge a number of these things. One would be it's... to be quite pejorative, it's ridiculous to think that we don't have a self. I mean, who doesn't have a self? I mean, understanding what one is or oneself is another issue.
Right.
And so the thought that how could we have any kind of like even communication, let alone organized internal experience without... some type of self-organization seems unbelievable to me. But I imagine people aren't thinking about the philosophical parameters when they say that. Mm-hmm. But it's another thing to say. I don't really know who I am in fully or completely. And I would fully agree with that. Of course we don't, because we're in the process of becoming. And so. I guess it really depends on those specific kinds of things that people are writing about. And yet at the same time, I can identify with that. I can identify with saying I don't fully know. I don't pretend to know. I'm in the pursuit of some type of process of looking for truth or universals or meaning in life. And there are many different forms or many different perspectives. And that I can fully agree in. So maybe we're not so far off in our vocabulary and our attentions than we think.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I mean, I guess I'm also thinking that a lot of my sense is the use of postmodern thinking in the psychoanalytic context it can focus also on a critique of authority. I get that sense that sort of the analyst's authority has importantly, and I don't work this way, so I think that authority is not a bad thing in the consulting room, but that sort of in the spirit of 1968, the analyst's authority has been thrown into question, and I wonder about how that impacts and how you would think what you think about the impact of that on the clinical on the clinical encounter.
Yeah, no, it's a very important topic, and I certainly am in sympathies with that line of thinking that if we are to assume that there is an authority figure out there, the one who knows, let's say the objective scientist, those who claim to possess absolute knowledge, then we think that that's preposterous. That's also a defense of grandiose narcissism or pretense, and yet. To be honest, I don't know if I've really encountered anybody like that in the real world. If we're setting up a straw man to attack, that's one thing. But I have encountered, of course, many people who feel they are right, and they're intolerant to critique or different points of view. Mm-hmm. And so one might be reminded of one's professors or one's supervisors or training analysts or whoever that you've encountered that pretend to have the one who knows, and if you don't cater to that, then there's going to be some real consequences. Mm-hmm. So I very much think that those stances need to be challenged.
Mm-hmm. But I was also I made the comment before about tolerating feeling stupid in the consulting room, and I'm thinking that the one who is supposed to know never has to sit with that feeling of not knowing and really being really profoundly in the dark. But I guess my question is in sort of the relational reformulation of the postmodern, it seems that things become about the here and now. There's this idea of co-creation, which you write about in the book, and that somehow sort of objectivity and epistemology find themselves disavowed. So I was wondering, where's the unconscious in when these ideas are at play? Is there an unconscious, or it just seems like the focus is more on something much, much, much more conscious, this co-creation. Do you have thoughts about this?
Yeah, well, I agree with that. It seems like that's where the emphasis is, at least from the readings that people present in their work, that it seems like the focus is upon the attunement to the here and now situation, mm-hmm. to the parameters of two subjects that are feeling one another out, that have a certain presence to bear on each other. And while I would certainly contend that that's true and that happens, it does appear that we've lost our third ear. Mm-hmm. We're not listening with that anymore. And yet I would imagine, to be fair to people, I mean, we don't know how everybody practices.
Right.
We don't know how they've amalgamated different theory over the years, what they've identified with, what they have renounced, how they uniquely developed their own way of facilitating a professional relationship. Mm-hmm. And these kinds of nuances are very difficult to write about. I can only go on my own experience, and that is where we are looking for patterns, whether they be defensive patterns, whether they be repetitions, whether they be transference enactments, and that's part of my work. It's simply not to dismiss the fact that a person has come to see you, and they're bringing their historical past to bear on. On coming to see you as a professional. And from that point of view, there is an element of authority that we as analysts or clinicians bring. And if that wasn't the case, then why would somebody be paying an obscenely high amount of money to see me?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You also have in the book, you write a lot about the hermeneutical turn, I guess we call it. And I'm not sure that I think making meaning is curative. What do you think making meaning is curative, and if so, how?
That's an interesting thesis that you put forward, that you don't see it as curative. And I guess we have to ask what that means, mm-hmm. because if we're using the metaphor of cure as such as inoculating against some kind of disease, then clearly. Meaning might not, serve that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm reminded of what Freud said, that the best we can do is, turn neurotic misery into ordinary happiness.
Uh-huh.
But there is something essentially healing to meaning making. And even if we don't like it, even if we find that truth unsavory, at least one's level of awareness has been expanded. Mm-hmm. It may open up a whole other can that we don't like, but nevertheless, it is what it is, and it's up to us to then take that information and make it or integrate it in a meaningful fashion. But I think ultimately that there has to be some curative element to the pursuit of meaning, even if we never get there.
Well, I think let me add something to my question, or flesh it out a little bit further, because one of the things that I wonder about is in sort of this focus on co-creation and mutuality and self-disclosure. These are key tenets of the relational work. I always think, what is the sort of pre-Oedipal or pre-verbal, the more narcissistically fragile patient do when confronted with, it seems to me that I think one of the things you say in the book is that the conscious mind seems to be perhaps privileged within the relational. I just always put myself, I say, well, what if I were in a fragile state? How do I work with this, the analyst's need for recognition? How do I work with, how do I survive that, actually?
Very, very good observations. It's a good question. How, because the last thing a narcissistic patient wants to hear is something coming out of your mouth.
Right.
Let alone that we would demand certain kind of mutual recognition from them.
Right.
So I'm not sure if people are actually practicing in a manner that they would foist their own need or desire for their patient to acknowledge them. It may just be something that just transpires naturally once a relationship has been developed. But I'm in agreement with you that a lot of these more regressed or people who are on more primitive organizations of self-development, whether it be narcissistically fragile or people who have more schizoid phenomenon or those on more of a borderline level of organization, that type of technique would probably backfire on you quite quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen it, and this could be, an oversight on my part. I mean, I'm well read in the relational, but not fully well-read. I never imagined that patient to be one that has pre-edipal or pre-verbal conflicts, and like, who doesn't? You know, so then I think, well, how do we work with that aspect of a person using with these ideas? You know, there's an idea about democracy, you know, for instance, in the consulting room. It's puzzled me. And maybe, you know, I mean, it's a way of working. It's a theory that is about a more object-related patient. Maybe that's who this way of working works best with, which, you know, is fine.
I guess the type of people I see are the same type of people you see.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have, you know, horrible developmental traumas.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever met an Oedipal patient.
Right.
So, that would be a delight if I could have someone come in and have the normal, your garden variety neurotic who just wants to be Woody Allen and talk about his day.
Very funny. Yeah. It's an ongoing question, you know, in my mind about this particular school of thought of like what patient, different schools of thought, you can kind of wrap your mind around the different kind of patient that is drawn or can be worked with in this way. You spend some time in the book talking about something you term therapeutic excess. And I was wondering if you could, in the context of discussing the relational, what do you mean by therapeutic excess, and what does it look like, and how to know it when we see it, and what about it concerns you?
Well, in reading the literature, there are certain analysts who have been very open about the way they practice in the consulting room. And to be honest, I really find that to be valuable, because we need to know what people actually say and what they do in order for us to have an honest discourse. So I do admire them in many ways for talking about what they communicate to patients. But some of the material that I read, I found like, well, that seems to me to be quite dangerous, particularly when we talk about excess. And what I mean by that is that there are certain excessive forms of self-disclosure that I've seen certain contemporary practitioners talk about, and whether it be breaching confidentiality, whether it be disclosing sexual feelings to patients in the session, mm-hmm. whether it be lying directly to patients, screaming at them while invading their face, And I, of course, we don't know the context of all these things, but that there is a certain, at least on the face of things, there may be a phenomenon that is happening in contemporary circles where they just do whatever they want, and they act out on certain countertransference processes. And so that's where I think we need to be careful about, particularly about the realm and the range of disclosures that take place, in session.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the because if you compare sort of the probably the straw man of American 1950s American ego psychology, right? So you have this very sort of, you know, withdrawn or hard to access figure of the analyst. And then we have this other figure contemporarily of the analyst, as you said, screaming in someone's face. I mean, couldn't be more different. But I guess I, how do you understand, I mean, this generation, our generation's such a strong reaction, and almost like a throwing out. It's a throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I would think to that more reserved figure. The year 1968 is always in my mind when I read the relational work. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but just in terms of the feelings about authority and about transparency. And I may have mentioned this to you in our lead up to the interview. I think I said something about presenting at an analytic institute, and an analyst said to me she did not like the use of the term psychoanalysis. I use it too frequently, and the use of the term unconscious. And she had very bad associations, sort of, even though she's an analyst, to these ideas. I was like, I wonder what has taken place to so turn people against the drives, the unconscious.
They were probably mistreated by their own analysts.
Yeah.
And then they generalize that and project that as a transference phenomenon onto theory.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Rather than thinking about the logical implications of what one says, such as there's no such thing as an unconscious. Well, that's amazing when people will write about that, or they'll allude to that, like everything is simply language or has been encapsulated by the Speech Act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's as if there's no dynamic unconscious activity that is a priori or that is operating prior to experience. And you'll see that with the relationalists, like from Mitchell to Greenberg in particular, mm-hmm. who more or less adopts a view that there is no unconscious prior to experience.
Right.
And I just don't buy that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you write someplace that Mitchell, his denunciation of the drives is beyond displacement. It's actually a negation, which, of course, made me think about what negation is and how it always contains within it its opposite.
A doubling of the negative.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little painful to read some of the quotes that you have in here from Mitchell, because they're so extreme. You have to wonder if the man was alive today, where would he be at with all this?
We'd probably be having a dialogue.
Right. Right. Yeah, I wonder about the impact of his death on the movement, because, you know, if he could have critiqued himself, which I imagine he had that capacity, I wonder if it's I sense in your book that you've received some very strong reactions to your critique of certain relational concepts or philosophical underpinnings. And your book is unique, certainly in that you have a chapter in which you really go into who said what, regarding difficult exchanges with some key relational thinkers, that there seemed to be no room for incorporating new ideas. And I wonder about Mitchell's death and the need to sort of defend the tradition, since he's not here.
And I think a lot of Mitchell's close friends have gone on to defend him, and of course there's a certain loving feelings that they have about this man, and they wouldn't want his work to be sullied.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is nothing personal.
Right.
I hope people don't take what I do as a direct assault or an attack on them personally. I'm really about interested in a critique of ideas, and that's what I think ultimately will push our field along to be more intellectually vibrant. And if we don't have an openness to critique and differences of opinion, and then tolerating the reasons for those differences, then we're not going to advance.
Right. Right. And I think as a field, we're, always we're at risk of extinction. There's kind of this, are we going to survive? Is psychoanalysis going to survive? And internecine battles are, of course, not usually that helpful. But another thing is they're, they end up being more destructive than constructive. They end up being less about desire than maybe about the death drive, the way that things are handled. And It was something to read that your chapter about responses you've received and being sent. I think you were censored. I can't remember the journal. That there was censoriousness, and I think Sandra Buechler, who I recently interviewed, called it psychoanalytic color wars. We can't seem to stop engaging in them. Apparently.
Well, yes, I think that as a profession, we love gossip and
right.
We just eat it up, and particularly about people who we may not like. So, in some ways, I feel I've been the designated mourner in that sense, but it's something I've chosen to take on as well. On one hand, there is a nasty side to psychoanalytic politics that's operative in any organization, just as it mirrors real life. Mm-hmm. And yet, unfortunately, when people exert their power differentials and manipulate others, and they don't allow a process of academic freedom and exchange of ideas to continue, then that's upsetting to me. So I felt a need to talk about these things on a real level and not censor that, because this is something that needs to be analyzed.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be acknowledged. And often people write about these things when other people have died and they have like a confessional.
That's true, yes.
When, if people are behaving badly, or unprofessionally, then they are not immune from criticism,
mm-hmm.
especially around censoring of academic freedom. So I felt the need to put that in there, and I hope it doesn't overshadow the other aspects of the book, because it seems like that people are commenting about that more than others.
Well, it's funny. I know that I've read some of the reviews, and people will comment on that. And I was just thinking about how, as a culture, we're so interested in reality, right? Like, there's nothing like a documentary. So many documentary channels, reality TV. And there's this chapter in your book which does get to sort of reality. Like, this is real politics. This is what people said. This is what happened. This is what I said. And I had the question, I was wondering, there seems to be a turn away in the relational movement from the intrapsychic or the inner world to the interpersonal. And it's an orientation towards reality. Do you think that the creation of relational analysis is sort of part of the zeitgeist?
Well, on one hand, I can fully identify with someone who is more warm and open and accepting and inviting, rather than someone who's cold, staid, emotionally reserved or removed. And I think this is the dichotomy of how we present the classical and the relational analyst.
Right.
When I think in reality, though, there's always a hybrid element. And instead of the bifurcation between the intrapsychic and the interpersonal, they both are operative at once and together. It's just a matter of where is the emphasis being placed. And I'm more of a comparative analyst, so I like to look at what people think in terms of theoretical foundations that drive their methodologies. And the relational, inevitability is, as you put it, to recapture the notion of 68, is really to rebel. It's to say, I don't want to practice like that because this is unnatural, or this is not meeting the real needs of patients. And you just have to look at your own experience of being in analysis or with supervisors who will tell you to do things that you think are palpably bizarre or just that are going to drive your patient away or are going to hurt them. And And I think in many ways, though, this is what is fostered in analytic institutes, is that you're supposed to just listen to daddy and do what you're told, rather than to think through something and have your own your mind about it and have a real discussion. But everybody's worried about failing, about being judged, about being shamed. And unfortunately, that kind of environment is not conducive to, an intellectual kind of debate.
It's almost as if working analytically in some institutes only happens in the consulting room with the patient, but it doesn't happen in training analysis or in the supervision.
So I'm told by many people.
Yeah. Yes, so I hear. I mean, I don't have that complaint about my institute, but I do hear that a lot. The feeling that you have to do what you're told, and that people are hiding things from their supervisors because the supervisor, wouldn't want to know about these things or would judge the candidate for having certain kinds of feelings and reactions to patients. I mean, it's pretty bleak to think that people are being exposed to something very unanalytic in their training to be analysts.
Well put.
You were going to say?
I was going to say that's well put.
Yeah, it's not. I was at a meeting the other night, and Otto Kernberg was there at the meeting, and it's with a group called the Unbehagen, which is a group here in New York of mostly people in training or people who've left training midway or are considering training. And we're sort of asking the question about, the formation of the analyst. So there's many Lacanians there, but it's not just. I'm there, I'm modern, there's interpersonalists there and, relational people. Sort of asking the question, what is it that makes one an analyst? So this group is kind of outside of the analytic training. And we meet and we have clinical study days and we just do things. We have speakers come and Kernberg came to address the group. And now, of course, I forgot what my question was. So funny. He came to address the group and was talking to us about training, and he's written these articles, 30 ways to kill the creativity of a candidate. And a question I asked him, I said, it seems when people graduate from institutes, they graduate also from supervision and analysis. And then the institutes they run amok. People force feed, their trainees and all the analytic candidates. And why do we give up so quickly our supervision and our analysis once we enter institute life? I don't know if that's what goes on in Canada, but it does go on here.
Well, I can't speak for everybody in Canada, but I'm sure I'm going to echo that sentiment in some circles.
Yeah, yeah, it's something. What else? I wanted to ask you a question. Also, does psychoanalysis need philosophy? I mean, you're trained as a philosopher as well as in a psychologist and a psychoanalyst. What do you think of as a ideal relationship or a close to ideal relationship between psychoanalysis and philosophy contemporarily?
Well, I'm not sure it needs it, but I would argue that ultimately it's enriched by it. Particularly when we're working with complex ideas that evoke, whether it be phenomenological, epistemological, or ontological concerns. And so, of course, psychoanalysis does all of that. Not only that, it's even broaching what it means to be an ethical or moral human being. So if you don't have some type of training, even if it's your own self-reading and self-education in philosophical circles, you're going to probably be hindered by understanding the complexity of things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it used to be that, that philosophy did not It didn't segregate itself from its subject matters. So it was interested in everything.
Right.
Yeah, I would argue that psychoanalysis has everything to gain by philosophical fortification.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the relational movement, which is, I think, as I said, an American homegrown product. I mean, do you have any sense of its relationship to various schools of American philosophy? I mean, would you say that, James, for instance, resonates within or any other sort of traditional American philosophers?
I suppose that, the people who've been writing in the field, they seem to be more all over the map. So, of course, who comes to mind is Donna Orange, who I think is a pragmatist ultimately. She has adopted James and Pierce's notion of a pragmatic theory of truth that she refers to more as a perspectival. And so in many ways, American pragmatism could be viewed as operative within contemporary circles because it is asking the basic questions like what is useful, what is helpful, what helps people get their goals or needs met, mm-hmm. and I think those pragmatic concerns are also what are driving the public in coming into treatment. Like, does it bake bread? So, I'm coming in to see you. I'm hoping that you're going to help me. And that means that one has to be attuned to the interpersonal nuances of tact and of pleasantries that perhaps maybe the old school or the old guard hadn't always fulfilled.
Right. Right. Interesting. You have an idea that I think people would be interested in understanding. And I believe you've published elsewhere more fully about this, which is the idea of dialectical psychoanalysis. Could you just describe what you mean when you use this term dialectical psychoanalysis?
Well, yes. In a nutshell, it is a neo-Hegelian notion of how the dialectic is operative within a psychoanalytic context. And so ultimately, I'm interested in offering a psychoanalytic metaphysics that is trying to explain how psychic reality is constituted.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to return to a radicalization of unconscious processes and believe that there's, in fact, an unconscious agency that is operative in everything that we do. And it conditions all of subjectivity and particularly consciousness. And in fact, it's the a priori ground that makes consciousness possible, hence makes relatedness possible, or language. So when contemporary people are writing about everything is based in language, or everything boils down to social construction, they really have then not realized they've just completely, displaced the foundation of our field.
I really was very interested in how you laid that out in this book, and you've written about it elsewhere, though, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, I published a book called Origins on the Genesis of Psychic Reality.
Yeah,
I lay out that system there.
Yeah, it's really you have a paragraph, I think, in this book that just grabs it, and I read it and I said, nothing's missing. Nothing struck me that nothing really was missing from that. There's room for everything, and you began at a substrate that felt really really humane to me. Interestingly, last weekend or the weekend before, the institute that I am training at, we had a conference with Nancy Chodorow, and she was the featured speaker. And I asked her a question, I made a comment to her. I said, around my institute, you can hear people ask the question, who were you before you met your mother? And she didn't like that that question, I don't think. That was not she said, how could there be a you, I mean, I understand, or an I before, you know, where you met your mother? But there is something there, and I think that part of your project is to, if I understand it, is to fight for that aspect of us before there is an I or an ability to recognize a you, and to make sure that that's not lost to the in your contemporary psychoanalysis.
I don't see why we need to exclude anyone or anything. It's really about a matter of emphasis. So I'm certainly the type that would give golden apples all around.
All right, we're going to bring our interview to a close. It's been very delightful to speak with you and to hear your ideas. We want to thank you for being with us at New Books in Psychoanalysis, and keep us posted about what's coming next. Send us your next book, you know, et cetera, because we're happy to talk to people again. So thank you very much, John Mills.
Well, thank you, Tracy, and congratulations on your Gradiva Award.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That was a delight. And everybody, we'll be back in, I don't know when, probably a month or 2 months, and we're going to be looking at heterosexual masculinities with a book by Bruce Reese and Robert Grossmark. So until then, bye-bye all for now.